Welcome to Eat, Capture, Share, the podcast for food bloggers, food lovers, and everyone in between. My name is Kimberly. I'm your host. Episode 64. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Eat, Capture, Share podcast. My name is Kimberly Espinel. I'm a food photography teacher, the author of the book, Creative Food Photography, How to Capture Exceptional Images of Food. And of course, I'm the podcaster here at Eat, Capture, Share. I'm back and bringing you this really, really, what I think is a super inspiring bonus episode featuring the one and only Joni Simon. As always, I'll tell you more about what the episode is about and what we chat about, but I've got a couple of announcements and things I wanted to share with you first, if that is okay. So the very first thing is, it's so bad to start a podcast with an excuse, but I have to. So we renovated the studio, which is also my office, which is where I'm recording this, and it is so echoey since the renovation. So I'm going to be speaking to my podcast editor this week so that when I come back for season 6 in the autumn, the audio is going to be bomb, okay? Like, let's just start with that. So for this episode, it's super clear, but it's a little echoey here and there, so forgive me. But listen, it's the content is amazing. Joni sounds fab, so do listen in. Now, I also wanted to let you know that there are a couple of giveaways happening this week and for the rest of this month. And the best way to know about them is, one, to follow me on Instagram, where I am at The Little Plantation. I'm going to be hosting a giveaway of Joni's book, Picture Perfect Food, this very week. So the week this comes out, 24th of May, 2021. So be sure to check out my grid for entry details. And then I'm also hosting a giveaway. And this is mainly for my email subscribers for a one-to-one mentoring session with me. So there's one more one-to-one mentoring session up for grabs. And the only way you can know about it and enter and take part is if you are on the mailing list. So be sure to head to the show notes and then link through to the website. And then at the end of the show notes, you'll see a sign up for the mailing list, which you should be on anyways. And the other reason you should be on there is because both Joni and I will be speaking at the Food Photography Summit that's happening next month, June 2021. And I can only really let you know the details if you're on the mailing list. So be sure to get on there. It's free, I believe. There is a VIP pass. If you order the VIP pass via my newsletter, I get a tiny little commission. So I'm an affiliate. I think that's the proper technical word for it. So be sure to sign up and join both me and Joni and then Jenna, who's hosting the summit. She was on the podcast as well. I think episode 61. But so we're all going to be sharing our knowledge, and I know there's so much content there that those of you who want to take your food photography and your food photography business to the next level will benefit from completely and totally. Great. Announcements done. Let me tell you a little bit more about today's podcast episode and my wonderful guest, Joni Simon. How should I say this? Joni Simon, no, let me backtrack. Behind the scenes, in my email, in my Instagram DM box, there are certain people that crop up that are just so incredibly supportive. And you never know if you just saw my Instagram grid or if you just listen to this podcast every so often, the support that I get from certain people behind the scenes. And Joni Simon is one of those people. We don't communicate often, but when we do, I just feel so empowered by her and so supported by her. And I feel she's a true industry friend that I can always count on. Her support when I launched my book, I don't know how many sales I made, like 250 books or something just through her support. But also, she's just a wonderful human being. She's an incredible photographer, an amazing, amazing teacher who inspires me and pushes me to be a better teacher. Because when I look at her teaching, I just think, oh, beautiful communication, so warm, so heartfelt, so empowering. And I hope that comes through in today's podcast episode. There was so much happening. I wanted to ask her so many questions. So I am rude and I interrupt her to pull out bits and pieces so you get the most out of this episode. And yes, we talk a lot about Joni's journey. And I know that a lot of times we look at food photographers and food bloggers who've quote unquote made it. And we think, oh, wow, you know, I could never be like them, or, you know, they were an overnight success. And what we don't know, again, is all the stuff that happens behind the scenes. So the long and winding road, the failures, the stumbles, the pain, the tears. And we dig a little bit deeper into that in today's episode. So if you're feeling despondent, if you're feeling like you're never going to get to where you want to get, this episode is for you. So without further ado, here's Joni Simon. Joni, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast. I think you're my most frequent podcast guest ever. So that goes to show how special you are. In case there's someone tuning in who's never heard of you or not quite sure, do you want to start with introductions?
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. I'm a frequent flyer. I feel very honored. So yeah, I'm Joni Simon, and most people know me from my YouTube channel, The Bite Shot, which I started in 2017, sharing things about food photography. And who knew that there was a whole world of people and community out there who were excited to join me in that journey. And so yeah, here I am today and celebrating a lot of fun milestones. And the other thing that I am definitely known for as well, which I think we'll get into in the conversation here today, is my passion for artificial lighting and light with food photography.
Amazing. I would love to start actually finding out a little bit more about what propelled you to start The Bite Shot, if there was a specific thing, and then also why you decided to do it on YouTube. Like, why did you make that your platform when there was Twitter and there's Instagram and Facebook and so many other platforms, but why did you kind of hone in on YouTube?
Yeah. You know, I think when we think about the way that our lives weave together, sometimes it's definitely, as you know, not a straight path. But I started a food blog. I mean, I'd been food blogging off and on since 2007, 2008, before we had the proliferation, all these gorgeous food blogs and food photos, and when the photography became such an emphasis. But, you know, I'd always been just sharing content online. And so in 2015, my life made a pretty significant change just in terms of leaving my day job and pursuing a life of sobriety, in line with just a lot of different things contributed to that big shift in my life. But kind of really focused my efforts into food blogging and really found myself enamored with the photography side of things. I mean, writing and like writing blog posts and things like that, like I'm good at and I can do, but it was the photography that really enchanted me. And so I started just creating more content and started to also connect with the restaurant industry. I'd had some connections there from a previous job and started to get hired then to do restaurant photography. And I thought, this is really interesting. And so kind of all these various things culminated when local food bloggers here in Phoenix, where I'm from, started to say, hey, can you teach us how to do food photography? Like, we really like what we see that you do. And so I started to hold little workshops here in Phoenix. And what I was finding, though, and you've probably found this too, as somebody who's taught workshops, you get in there and you're like, okay, I don't want to teach the same camera settings every time. Like, I want to get in and get into the really fun stuff, like the creative stuff. And so I thought, you know, if I just create some YouTube videos that can instruct these folks how to operate a camera in manual mode, then we can have more fun in the workshop. So I was kind of sending that ahead of time. And also, sort of backstory too, is that prior to that, I'd also been creating YouTube content, like recipe content. So I already was familiar with the YouTube platform and knew that I had the ability to talk to a camera, which I don't think everyone is comfortable with or has developed that muscle and that skill. But I had a background in performance and things like that. So it was much more natural for me. And I thought, well, you know, this is a platform that makes sense to me. And I like to show like that instructive part of my teaching. And I thought that YouTube was the best way to like leverage that. And so creating those videos for those local bloggers certainly helped, but suddenly lo and behold, there was a whole audience waiting for that teaching
content. Yes, lo and behold, there they were, thousands and thousands of them. Julie, exactly. There's so much in your story I would love to kind of dig a little bit deeper into, if that's okay. Absolutely. So the very first thing I'd love to hear a little bit more about is you mentioned that 2015 was kind of a moment where you chose sobriety, and you have spoken actually very openly on your channels about your history with alcohol, and which I think is so brave and so giving. So thank you for that. Mm-hmm. But it's also very personal and very vulnerable. And I'd love to know why you decided to share that story, that part of your life with your community.
Yeah. What spurred the sobriety were some things in life that happened in 2014. And I started to see an amazing therapist who, you know, I say is a gift from God. She's an angel here on earth, and just really helped to clarify some things for me and help to give me the coping tools necessary to deal with things like anxiety and stress and life. And, you know, we don't always have the best coping mechanisms. And so really helped me in that way. And, you know, there's certain things too. I think anybody who's been on a sober journey, where you're going from addiction into recovery, there's a certain amount of miraculousness that happens there that I can't quite pinpoint, but I'm eternally grateful for. But I think for me, I've always been a person who likes to help others. People. And I think that in that process of learning how to live a sober life, and also the accountability factor, that I thought, I can't not share this. This seems too big and too important. And I felt like this compulsion. Like, I think that I'm a person who leads with intuition a lot of times. And there was just something inside of me that said, you need to put this out there. You need to do this not only for yourself, but also sort of a process of that healing journey. You know, we talk about the 12-step program and the process of making amends, as well as then also, you know, helping other people in their own sober journeys. And whether that may not be alcohol for everybody, but I think we all know somebody who's been touched by or affected by an addiction, you know, and not, if not themselves, somebody very close to them. So I shared that story for the very first time. I was probably only, I think I was about 6 months sober at that point. So it's still very fresh and new for me, but people had very much prior to that defined me as this person who's got it all together, who's got this perfect family and has, you know, all these, and that we didn't necessarily, Instagram wasn't necessarily a big focus at that point, but, you know, Facebook, and everybody just looked at this perfect family, this perfect person, and suddenly coming clean and saying, no, I'm not, I'm very far from perfect. And here's what I'm struggling with, and here's what I'm working on. And it was really beautiful then, just the outpouring of love and support that I got from other people, and how I think it can just serve as a reference point for people who are struggling. And so I've always kept that story. It's not necessarily something I focus on in a major way, but it is an undercurrent, I think, to what I do and the transparency that I try to infuse in my education and in my brand. And it's just really neat, just all the stories. I can't tell you the number of stories that I receive from people saying, hey, amazing, I've been struggling. And it's pretty remarkable. So a part of it, I would say, like a big part of why I shared that was intuition. And I'm, my intuition has never steered me wrong when it's truly intuition.
Amazing. Joni, thank you so much for sharing that. And really, really grateful for you being so open and honest about it. And now the other bit of your story is that you're like, well, you know, just casually people ask me to photograph their restaurants, and, you know, and I just did that. So I would love to know how that just kind of sort of happens, especially because I know that people are listening in who would love to photograph for restaurants or food in general. And do you have any tips or advice how to overcome kind of fear of asking and any sort of strategies that you've noticed really help to build those kind of relationships that you built at the start of your career and that still serve you?
So, you know, it's interesting because I think we're in an evolving time as far as just the access to clients and the way that we market ourselves in the world. You know, technology changes so much. But when I got started, and I was also, in addition to food blogging and creating recipe content, I had a podcast where I was interviewing local restaurants and local chefs. And different restaurateurs and personalities. And so as a part of that, I was creating content for my blog, as well as for, you know, kind of the budding Instagram accounts at that point. And so I would say, hey, I'm going to interview you. You'd be on my podcast, but I also need to come to the restaurant and just take a couple pictures of your signature dishes to include with that content. And so that was how that very first job came about, was one of those interviews. And I came in, shot two of the signature dishes, and about a couple weeks later, their PR person reached out and said, hey, you know, we really like those photos. Can you come back and shoot the rest of the menu? And of course, amazing. I'm like, you want me to do what? Oh, okay, what am I supposed to charge for this? Oh my gosh. And it was so funny because, you know, I've got one picture that the PR person took of me doing that photo shoot. And it's like this funny memory because I think we photographed something like 20 dishes. And so it was like a lot of food. And I was, it was just me and my little camera with a kit lens. There were no modifiers. There were no artificial lights. It was literally just me and a camera, no tripod. But it was great. But I remember being absolutely exhausted because I was like, I just photographed food for 3 hours straight, which now, I mean, you know, photo shoots can last like all day and multiple days. But I remember I was terrified and I was so scared, but I was also really excited. And I feel like,
Joni, sorry, I'm going to be really rude and stop you right there, because I know there are people who are tuning in. They're like, okay, if somebody asked me to shoot that whole entire menu, I'd be so terrified and I would probably wouldn't do it, or self-sabotage or what have you. Like, despite the fear, how did you overcome the fear and kind of go like, yeah, I'm going to do it and this is what I'm going to charge? Like, how did you make that happen?
Yeah. You know, because I feel like those are always the moments where we grow the most. And I have those moments. I still have those moments when somebody asks me to do something and I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready for that. I don't know if I have the tools necessary. But I feel like my curiosity to try is always stronger. Like the fear, I've always been really good at identifying that fear is an inevitable part of the process. Because I do think there's also common sense when you know, like, I literally don't have the skills to do this, right? Like, you have to, I think, decipher between things that it's like, if somebody asked me to shoot a feature film for Hollywood tomorrow, I would say, I'm sorry, I lack the skills in order to execute that or the desire to do that. But when somebody asks you to do something that, like, you get that nervous feeling, but you, like, also know, I could probably do this, right? And I also think the thing that I continue to always come back to, because I do think that risk-taking is a big part of building your business, is coming back to what's the worst that could happen, right? What's literally the worst thing that could happen? Love and it. In that scenario, they hate the photos. Okay. Is anybody's life on the line? Is anybody bleeding? No, like this is in that case, then you say, I'm so sorry. And here's your money back, or let's do a reshoot. Or, you know, if that's the worst thing, then I can continue on, you know? So I still come across those, but I think now I think you get stronger at this too, because now I continue to have moments where somebody will ask me like to do a job. And, you know, there was a big cookbook that I shot this past year that I was for sure super nervous about because of the scope of it and the way it was going to be executed. But I also was like, but this is a challenge. And I know the fear is normal and I'm going to do it anyway. And I'm so proud that I did. And was it stressful and nerve-wracking and scary in the middle of it? Of course. But now can I go on to something else even bigger next time? Because now I've developed that skill set, you know? So I think that, yeah, living in that discomfort of, can I do it? Yes, I can. But leaning into fear.
Love it. Now, Joni, there's one other piece of your story that I'd like to dig into before we go and talk a little bit more about your book and also about this cookbook that you shot. Yeah. There's so many people who start YouTube channels around food or photography or food photography, and not everyone has the success that you have. Are there any tips or any bits of advice that you could share with the listeners, who anybody who's thinking about starting YouTube or has started a YouTube and it just hasn't quite happened for them yet? Anything that you think really allowed you to obtain the success that you have? Anything that you can share?
Yeah, you know, this is my second YouTube channel, The Bite Chat. The first one was the recipe content. And that one, I mean, I did all the things that all the experts tell you to do in the YouTube world. You know, I'd go to all the seminars and all the trainings on YouTube because I was like, I just really want to cook on YouTube. Like, I want to be one of those people. And I could never figure it out. And and then suddenly, I mean, I went hard on that for like 2 years, from 2015 to 2017, uploading 3 times a week and the right length and doing all the keywords and all, you know, all those things. And so then suddenly when I started The Bite Shot and started sharing content that was literally for the sole purpose of just like helping these very specific people, you know, I had these bloggers who I wanted to help shoot in manual mode. And I think, you know, and I kind of left behind worrying about, you know, the way that I'm supposed to do it because the experts tell me this is how it's supposed to, you know, like playing all those games. I think sometimes we're sold by the experts and gurus in the field that there's like this one way to do it. And I just thought, no, I'm just going to do this the way that makes sense to me and that I would want to be taught, because I remember exactly what it was like to be in those folks' shoes, not knowing how to operate my camera. And I think that's where the real difference was. Very specific people with a very specific need that I'm able to fulfill. And that was very different. And that suddenly then too, when creating the content became so much easier, because I remember creating the recipe content and it was like this uphill battle. Like I just felt like I was pushing this boulder uphill for 2 years and not getting it anywhere. And then, you know, I start this channel about photography thinking, I don't even know if I can create a, like if I can sustain a channel full, like how would I ever do more than, you know, a dozen videos? Well, I'm here to tell you there's more than enough content in the world to fill a whole YouTube channel with food photography, but it suddenly became a lot less difficult. But I wouldn't have found that had I not spent the 2 years of pushing the boulder uphill. Like, so I never, ever discount the value of those years of trying things and experimenting and finding what, you know, what wasn't natural. Because I also think that we're all gifted in unique ways and the value that we bring to people is specific and is unique, but we don't know it until we've tried a lot of different things. And then suddenly these things kind of reveal themselves. And I would like to say that I was super intentional about it, but I wasn't. And I don't play the games of the algorithm. And for me, people go, oh, don't you wish you had like a million followers, right? Because to me, like when I hit 10,000 subscribers on YouTube, my mind was blown. I was like, oh my gosh, I have reached the pinnacle, right? But the problem is like suddenly you reach these certain metrics and then people start saying, oh, well, when are you going to hit this one? And when are you going to hit this one? And it's like this constantly moving target. And so I really try to focus on being happy with and content with, which I am. I'm like, if my audience never grew anymore, I'd be so happy with it. Cause I think that there's so much value in that, in the smaller community, and that you can really get deep with people. And so I don't worry as much. I really don't pay attention to the metrics other than if a sponsored post is coming around and somebody wants to know what the numbers are, because to me it's all about continuing to serve the audience that I show up for and finding out what is going to be most helpful for them. And so I think that translating that into food blogging and you know, other YouTube content is thinking about, yeah, what is really going to make these people's lives easier or better, yeah. or, and maybe that's entertainment and maybe that's instruction, but you got to get out there and make a mess and
yes.
fail, but it's never failure, you know?
There's a couple of things here that I'm hearing you say, but the first thing that really struck me is that you didn't allow the quote unquote failure of your first channel to stop you from going at it again and trying something new. So I love that. Mm-hmm. What I'm also hearing you say is that there was lots of lessons that you took away from that, you know, from that first attempt that maybe consciously or unconsciously you would have brought to the Bite Shot channel. Yeah. But then also that now the success of it was really because you're doing something you're super passionate about, doing something quite niche. And over time, you've really learned to understand and know who your audience is and what their needs are, and you're continuously meeting it, and you totally love what you do. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a journey to get there, you know, because I think when I started the Bite Shot, and it took off very quickly, in my opinion, you know, and people are like, oh, it's like this overnight success. I'm like, oh, let me tell you, this is not overnight. Like this is the culmination of teaching on college campuses for the better part of 10 years and spending years in Toastmasters learning public speaking. And this is learning photography. And this is 2 years of constant work on another YouTube channel that never made me any money. And, you know, so any overnight success is usually a decade in the making.
You see, because I feel the same way, because I taught as a side hustle thing. Because I would say I've had two midlife crises. My first one was when I turned 30. I was like, no, I want to be a yoga teacher.
Nice.
And I did, but then I did it as a side hustle for 10 years. So I taught yoga for 10 years. And then my second mini midlife crisis was when I turned 40. I was like, I want to be a food photographer full time. Mm-hmm. So I'm still in that one. But what I mean is, like, I've been teaching for 10 years, you know, for 10 years straight. And even before that, my role as an adoption social worker, we have to do presentations and go to panel and speak at court. And you know what I mean? Like, it's not like I just walked up and I'm like, I'm gonna start a podcast. I've never spoken about and like all these skills that you don't really think about, but actually they're building blocks to what you then go on to create. And sounds like your story is very similar to mine in that respect. So that's really amazing to hear.
I know. That's why I was so excited for this interview and why I just always love talking with you, because I'm like, oh, Kimberly knows how to listen. She is, because she's a professional listener.
That's actually what you are as a social worker. You're supposed to listen. That's it.
Like, that's why she's such an incredible podcaster. So I think, you know, when people can connect those dots and not intentionally, but you start to see how these, like, no experience is ever wasted, that absolutely, those things come back around and can and morph in different ways. And it's beautiful.
Love it. Now, you're teaching on college campuses to teaching on YouTube has led you really beautifully to teaching now through your book. And I'd love to know how that all came about. And then there's so many food photography books out there. How could you ensure that your book was uniquely Joni Seidel?
So I definitely came at the book process, I think, from a backwards route of the publisher. There were two different publishers who'd kind of approached me around a similar time frame. And I honestly hadn't been thinking of doing a book, because I think that I have so many ideas and so many things that I want to do. And so, you know, a book seemed like such a monumental task that I'm like, I feel like that's going to take a while. But the more I started to think about it, I thought, this is a different medium than I've taught in before. And this is a way to make the education accessible in a different way, because I think different people learn different ways. Yes. And when we can serve the audience in those variety of methods, it's super helpful. And so, you know, started to talk to the publisher. And what I really liked was this particular publisher was very open and very flexible and kind of said, you know, we love what you do and we totally trust you. What is it you want to create? You know, and I think that as a creative person, when we're given that license to really make something that's uniquely us, that's exciting. And so, and it was also too in line with the world started to shut down in terms of the pandemic. It was, I believe, March when I signed the contract. And so it was like, oh, well, I got some free time on my hands. Let's write a book. That seems like a really great idea, which in retrospect, I mean, I'm so glad it went that way, but it's also, you know, it'll be interesting 10 years from now to look back on that book. And I think about being in lockdown and the limitations and just the mental place that I think we're in the midst of a pandemic and crisis and uncertainty and things like that. But yeah, I did. I had the time and the availability, and I really put pedal to the metal and made the book happen. So it was, as far as from the standpoint of making it unique, because I definitely wanted something that was more aimed at what I would say is where so much of my audience starts, which is that entry level. Like I really wanted a firm foundation that was something that was comprehensive from the entry perspective, but at the same time have enough interest and excitement in there that somebody who's more seasoned could still gain value out of it. And so I think that so much of that is that direct application. And so that's why it was super important to me for every single lesson that then it also came with some sort of activity. And I was too kind of inspired by, you know, like daily devotionals and things like that. Let's make a food photography version of that. You know, I've got these for other areas of my life and, you know, self-improvement and all these other things, but like, let's take food photography into that. And that created a really great structure then for me to plug in what I thought was sort of that basics, that if somebody could go through all of these things in a year, that they could build their skills from there. And I think too, you know, having talked to now other folks who've read it and who've, you know, read all the other awesome books that are out there, like yours and Bee's and Andrew's and Helen's, is that we all still have our own unique approach to things. And that, you know, there's not, you could never just read one food photography book, that everybody's bringing their own approach and eye and interest to things. And I think that too, just from an aesthetic standpoint, you know, they're all so wildly different. And I know I get so inspired by looking at other people's imagery. And that was also something that was important to me from the nature of creating the images for the book, that I wasn't just pulling from archives, but that I was creating explicitly for this book with an aesthetic and with example images that could spur somebody on to try something out themselves. You know, that there are certain foods that, like the peanut butter on honey on toast, which is a super popular dish here at the Simon household. Boys, it's one of their favorites. But, you know, then also thinking this is something that is approachable and easy for somebody to style, then too, if they're brand new to food photography, that this would not be an overwhelming dish to recreate and photograph for themselves.
Gotcha. And tying the book that you shot for yourself, so it's, or for your community, with the experience of also shooting the cookbook, what is that one called again, please?
So there's two. There was the one prior to that was Phoenix Cooks, which is a local cookbook here in Phoenix. And it includes recipes from 50 different local chefs. So we had 50 chefs participating in a photo shoot, which was a riot.
And then the most recent one was?
Yeah. So it's Crazy Sweet Creations from Anne Reardon, who she's a YouTuber out of Australia. So, you know, when folks say, how do you do a remote shoot? I say, oh, let me tell you, it is, it's an adventure trying to navigate time zones from Pacific time zone to Australia.
Insane. But I'd love to know, having now shot three books, what you've learned through that process. And again, you know, I know so many people dream of either shooting their own book or shooting cookbooks. You know, are there any skills, anything that you think would help creatives reach that goal and make the most of that experience?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly no discount to the planning that is required to execute that. And I feel like, you know, having been through a variety of different kinds of shoots in terms of the scope and the way they're executed, that, you know, when it comes to executing, I mean, something as big as a book, right? That you're talking 50 plus images of different subjects, that when the budget and the scope allows, that having additional hands and additional people involved in that process can really help to just streamline the process. You know, I think back to Crazy Sweet Creations, which is 50 desserts, but these were very high-end desserts with a lot of complexity. So hiring a professional pastry chef to execute those recipes, because my pastry skills tap out at like kind of the basic box cake mix. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I knew I needed a professional for that. But because we were in the midst of the pandemic, we weren't able to have a larger crew for that. But, you know, it stretched out over the course of a whole month because of just we could only shoot two in a day because of from the production side. But thinking through, you know, like other, like the Phoenix Cooks, where we have additional people and additional resources where we can get through 5, 6, 7, 8 in a day. Mm-hmm. And so that helps to kind of expedite that process. Because I think, I don't know about you, but I know for me, one of the things that has been a huge eye-opener is how emotionally taxing a large long-term project can be. Mm-hmm. That when I have a short attention span, and so when I'm like, I am still working on this, you know. So if you can, for me, you know, knowing that about myself in the future in shoots, how can I incorporate other people or other resources mm-hmm. in order to maximize the time so that we can maybe get through this quicker? Because, you know, but maybe certain projects do just, they take a long time, and that's a part of the process as well. But, yeah. You know, when we're working, like, you know, when I shot my book, it was me doing all of the cooking and the planning and the propping yeah. and the styling and the dishes. And, you know, so you can only get through one or two in a day.
Yeah. But so, you see, I think I generally work with a team. Like 9 yeah. out of 10 times I work with a team, and mm-hmm. that's been actually really transformative for me mm-hmm. where it's about kind of me stepping into the role of I'm the photographer, you know, like mm-hmm. it feels a little bit scary, but I've noticed that I get more done, and also mm-hmm. it's just physically very, like a whole day of shooting is exhausting anyway. But then mm-hmm. if I have to style and I have to prop and I have to shoot mm-hmm. and I have to edit and I have to, you know, like if I have to hold all those pieces.
Oh, so much.
Yeah, I just find it too much because I shot my book part of the pandemic as well. So I mm-hmm. had to do quite a bit on my own. But for yeah. that part, I did no more than 2 book shoots a week. Because yeah. I just couldn't, you know, I just could not fit. Like I was just drained. I remember yes. just being drained. And then when things like towards the end of the book shoot here in the UK, things opened, I brought my team back in. So, you know, obviously following COVID regulations and this, that, and the other. And that was so helpful. So just them making the dishes, and then, yeah. you know, I would do the final touches here, or I would, you know, just, oh, it's just so much better. It's just so much better, you know. And I think I think it just means my energy levels are different. If I mm-hmm. have, also sometimes, you know, you want to bounce ideas of other people.
Oh, yes.
Does that look as good? Like, should we make it a little sexier? Like, I don't know. Like, you know, I just love that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think the creative ideas that come out of that or the things you're going to miss. But I also think, too, mm-hmm. I get so many more like of those ancillary shots mm-hmm. when I have a team, because my brain is free to yes. focus more on the photography and see things that suddenly I'm like, oh, that little ingredient right there, or oh, that little detail right there, that that's especially it. From a book perspective, because, you know, yes, we have all the hero shots or the, you know, main illustration that goes with this recipe or this point or whatnot. But then, you know, what goes in the inside cover and what goes in these other little spots in the book jacket and these other little things that we just need these extra shots, those come yeah. out of a freer mind that's yes. able to be watching for those things.
Yes. And I have to say, I would never have known to work with a team if it hadn't been for the fact that I worked as a prop stylist, like at the very start of my career as a prop stylist on a couple of really big cookbooks. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they had food styling assistant, They had me as the prop stylist. I had a photographer. The photographer had an assistant. And then there was an art director on the shoot as well.
Yeah.
Oh. And I just remember thinking and just observing everything and like, ah, so this is why those books look like amazing,
it's
right?
True.
You know, because there's so many people who each take responsibility and then together that team energy, you know, just makes everything. And, you know, I'm not at that stage yet that I have such a big team, but I just knew that that's what I'm working towards.
You know? Yeah. And so, I think it's like little steps though, right? Because exactly. I remember the very first time I ever worked with a food stylist. And that was like, talk about another overwhelming, kind of scary, nerve-wracking experience. Like, okay, I've only ever done this by myself. Now I'm bringing somebody else in. But like, finding out that that was, like you said, so helpful. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, for folks who are like, because I do think like it's mentally overwhelming to think, okay, I'm going from doing this myself to now there's this whole team. And I think that, yeah, it's like this step by step and you go, oh, that's where, yeah, a prop stylist. Oh man. I mean, those are the best.
But Joni, your book looks incredible, looks amazing. And before we bring the interview to a close, I do want you to share where people can get it. But I've got a couple more questions before we do, if that's okay with you. Absolutely. So for creatives who are tuning in, who are maybe doing food photography as a side hustle, they want to go pro. Do you have any tips from gear to lighting to anything that you think is helpful from moving, you know, really taking that big leap forward to say shooting cookbooks and so on?
Yeah. I mean, I think certainly technique and skills, and we're always all advancing what it is that we know and we can do. But I think that it's all, when I think back to how I've grown my business, that it really comes back to the connections and the people. And, you know, I can't remember where I read this or where it came from, but the difference between me now and me a year from now is the people I meet and the books I read. Mm-hmm. And so whenever there's opportunity to pick up a new book or meet a new person, I'm all about it, because you just never know what might serve you in the future. And especially when we talk about cookbooks and things like that, the opportunities I've been brought into have been a result of knowing the author. Mm-hmm. Now, did I meet the author explicitly because I knew someday they'd become an author? No, we just had a mutual interest in food and in, you know, content and all the, so these connections are made. So I think that getting yourself connected and shaking, I mean, hopefully once the world opens back up again, you know, going to conferences and going to events and shaking hands, even connecting with people on Instagram and complimenting them on their work. You just never know where these different connections will fall into place.
You know, it's so funny you say that, because like I did a mastermind a few years ago, and the people I met there, a lot of them I'm still in touch with. Mm-hmm. When I went to a workshop as a student, a lot of the other students there, I'm still in touch with. Those connections are so, they're super valuable, just as valuable as having a camera, you know, that's super duper amazing.
Like, you'll figure the technical stuff out. You know what I mean? Like, and that will all grow, and that's education that's out there. But yeah, it's those connections that will really serve you well.
Yeah. Now, Joni, you said at the very start that a lot of people know you for your passion for artificial light. And I would love to know what role artificial light has played on your journey. Do you feel that it's opened a lot of doors, a lot of opportunities? Is it a skill set that you think is helpful to have under your belt?
Yeah. I mean, I first started shooting artificial light and trying to figure it out, because as a mom with two young children, you know, daylight hours were not necessarily prime time for photography. And I don't know, there was something in me that's like, I just got to figure this out. So that to me has been really helpful. I would say you can absolutely, you know, people say, oh, do I have to have it to create a career in food photography? And no, you can absolutely, natural light is beautiful and you can do so much with it. But for me, I just really, it's that stress factor of wanting to eliminate one more thing, you know, that I can focus my efforts in other ways. And I have found though, and the thing that I think gets me so jazzed about artificial light is how much, when I really dug into it, how much I learned about light. And then I was able to then reverse engineer it back into natural light, because I do think that the two are so important to understand together, not necessarily combining them, but to understand the way in which artificial light works. And then going back and thinking about, oh, well, that's why the sun is doing that. And that's why this window is doing this. And that's why I like the way that looks. So we can kind of reverse engineer things. But then, you know, by watching natural light, getting so inspired, you know, I'm sure we all do this, right? You walk through a space and suddenly you see the way the light is hitting the table and the flowers in the vase, and you go, oh my gosh, that's gorgeous light. So I'm constantly thinking about, how do I take what is beautiful natural light and turn that into artificial light? Like, yes, take my artificial lights and incorporate it that way. Because I do think food, you know, the real emphasis is to create something that looks natural and true to life and believable. Mm-hmm. That at the same time, I've learned so much as a result of going down the rabbit hole of learning artificial light, mm-hmm, that I feel like really helps me to harness it. And there's certainly two been shoots, you know, I think about, again, you know, the Crazy Sweet Creations cookbook. I was working with a pastry chef who was on a very specific schedule. Yeah. And we were also shooting for a client in Australia who she could only, you know, because of the hours, our start time would be at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, our time, gotcha, as opposed to starting first the day. So we'd be shooting into the night. And so, gotcha, knowing that we needed that flexibility, I don't know how else we would have necessarily done that particular shoot had I not been using artificial lighting. So I think it does free certain things up. I think it makes things more flexible, but I also have a lot of fun with it personally. I find it's just like, to me, just like working with paints, it's working with all my lights.
Gotcha. Now, I know that some of your gear is quite pricey. Is it worth investing in artificial light at the kind of spectrum that you're at? And why did you decide to get the lighting that you have? And for people on a tighter budget, like, what do they lose going with a more affordable light versus what you've got? And when did you know you were ready kind of for the full Monty?
Yeah. So some people would argue that because I don't shoot with the top of the line, you know. So
oh, is it? No, there's more.
Oh, there's the rabbit hole goes deeper.
Oh my God.
So sometimes I get judged from the, there's an audience that I don't cater to on YouTube, and they exist and I acknowledge them. And then I go on my merry way, go, well, you know, and I'm like, okay. So, but that being said, yeah, there is absolutely a spectrum. So my recommendation is always to start with something affordable, because really light is light, right? So whether it's coming from a $60 speed light or my $900 strobe or somebody's $10,000 strobe, that it's producing photons, you know? Mm-hmm. And so to me now, the reason to start upgrading or start going with more expensive ones is that they are going to last longer. So you're more of a long-term investment in terms of gear. They may have other certain advantages, like they may plug into the wall as opposed to being powered by AA batteries. So certain things in terms of workflow, but in terms of the way the actual light is going to look, you know, if I take, for example, speed lights, which to me are a great place to start in artificial lighting, because we can do a lot with them and they're not super expensive, mm-hmm, that you can take a $60 Godox speed light and you can take a $700 Canon speed light, and I can shoot them with the same modifier. So like a soft box or an umbrella, or shoot it through some diffusion, you know, maybe a curtain or something like that, and create literally the same exact look. Yeah. Now that Canon speed light may last 5 or 6 years. That cheap $60 one, maybe it'll last 2 or 3. So it's about more that long-term investment. But to me, I say start with what you can afford, because you also don't know if this is going to be the direction you're going to go in. You know, that I think it's an important skill to have, but I don't think it's necessarily like, you may not fall in love with it. Plenty of people do. Like when I moved into my strobes, part of that was, you know, I was just tired of changing out the AA batteries on these smaller, more affordable speed lights. So I got something that can plug into the wall and can go all day long and is a bit more powerful. So I can shoot at, like, you know, higher f-stop. So when I'm shooting, you know, product at f22, I need a pretty powerful light unless I'm going to dip into my ISO. So it's sort of some of those things, but it's much more when it comes to that price point. It has nothing to do with the way that the light is going to look. It's just like a fancier camera is not going to get you better pictures. It's just literally making life easier, or it's going to last longer and accomplish that, those goals.
Amazing. Yeah. Joni, thank you so much for sharing so much knowledge. To be honest, I could talk to you for another whole hour.
I know.
I really always feel that. I know, I always say that, but I really always feel that. But I'd love to know what is next for you. What is on the cards? What other big projects? Now that the book is written and out in the world, what else can we expect of you?
Yeah. I was talking to my husband the other day and I said, okay, what am I supposed to do with my life now? What am I supposed to be when I grow up? And he's like, are you kidding? I was like, because it is sort of this funny feeling of, you know, this big monumental project is now in the world and I've done a big update on my lighting course. And, so right now I'm coasting along for a while. I'm going to create YouTube content. I'm going to continue to serve my clients and, you know, take on smaller opportunities. But I think I'm going to let life breathe for a little bit, because I think that sometimes those in-between spaces give us indication to the next big thing. So just taking a little while to catch my breath.
Nice. And, you know, sometimes when we have those quiet moments, that's when new ideas also pop up into our brain. And also, can I just ask, because I know that you're a bookworm, you just said, is there anything interesting that you're reading at the moment?
Oh, okay. Where is it? It's here on my desk somewhere. It's called, I believe it's called Understanding Color, is a very general term, but it's specifically for designers. And to me, it is the most comprehensive, in-depth, detailed book I've read thus far on the topic of color and color science, which I find really interesting, because I think that, you know, as much as we can always learn more about light and that's so powerful, color is so mysterious and magical. Mm-hmm. And so really, really trying to dig into color right now is a focus for me.
Well, let's see what comes out of that. So,
yeah. Who knows?
Great. Joni, can you let everybody know where they can find you? Can you let them know the name of your book and where to get it? And where to connect with you?
Of course. So all roads lead back to thebiteshot.com. That's where you can find links out to the different retailers for my book, Picture Perfect Food. That's available at all the typical retailers like Amazon, Book Depository and whatnot. And then, thebiteshot.com will take you out to my Instagram at thebiteshot and YouTube. So youtube.com/thebiteshot.
Amazing. Joni, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Kimberly.
Isn't Joni as sweet and lovely as I told you she would be? I know that she would love it if you stop by her Instagram comment section and let her know that you listened in on this podcast episode. If you enjoyed it, then be sure to share it on Instagram stories too and to tag both me and Joni so we can reshare it for sure. Now, another thing, my podcast review game is weak, okay? Like, it's super weak. So if you love the podcast, if you get value from it, and if you'd like to support the podcast and ensure that more creatives and food lovers like you find it, be sure to leave a rating and review. It would mean so much. Now, like always, everything and anything mentioned in today's podcast episode, including Joni's social, her book, the other book she talked about, the summit, all the things are linked to in the show notes, so be sure to check those out. And then I will be back for season 6 at the very tail end of August. So until then, stay well and see you then. Before I leave you, I wanted to say thank you so, so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. I also wanted to let you know that this podcast was brought to you by my Eat, Capture, Share newsletter community, and I'd love for you to join. I will pop the details on how you can join my creative community in the show notes, so do go and check it out. Also, if you enjoy the podcast, it means so much if you can rate, review, and subscribe. All those things will help the podcast to grow and to reach the right audience. And yeah, you'd kind of make my day. All right, see you soon. Take care. Bye.